Good morning, and welcome to Air Occupy. I'm Liz, and together with Shannon, Virginia, and Jerry, we speak truth to power and occupy your mind. Today, we are going green. We are going to talk to Dr. Gretchen Goldman, a co-author of the Union of Concerned Scientists report on corporate control of the national conversation about climate change. And then we'll be talking with to Deep Green Resistance activist Rachel Collins, and she'll be telling us about Deep Green Resistance and its above-ground radical environmental movement and their upcoming Resistance Roadshow. If you want more information about these topics that we're going to discuss, go to our Facebook page or to our blog, which is at airoccupy.blogspot.com. And we're going to post the links to the Union of Concerned Scientists report, so you can check that out. And we'll also have a link to Deep Green Resistance, so you can read about them while we're talking. You can also tweet us during the show at Air Occupy. And, of course, call into the show at 386-523-1380. But first, we have a little update on a past show topic. Big news pieces came out last week about voter registration and voter suppression.
A couple of good developments, both from the federal courts and the Department of Justice, finally on a couple of the issues we discussed when we had the League of Women Voters on the show a few weeks ago. The first is regards the voter registration law that was passed in 2010. And Judge Hinkle of the Federal District Court up north decided that the restrictions on community-based registration efforts were unconstitutional. Particularly, he invalidated the 48-hour deadline that had been imposed on groups like Rock the Vote and the League of Women Voters, who were out trying to register voters, that they be turning in those registrations within 48 hours. The judge, and I'm going to quote from his opinion, said that this law had no other purpose other than to discourage voluntary participation in legitimate, indeed constitutionally protected activities. So that's a great decision. It looks like the League of Women Voters is going to come back into the process and begin, again, community-based registration. We hope the same happens with other community-based groups that do registration work so that we can get everyone registered for the upcoming elections.
Definitely.
Yeah, that's great.
The second major development is now with respect to this recent voter purge that you may have heard about, instituted by Governor Scott, which he is using a 182,000-person database that he's received from the Department of Motor Vehicles in an attempt to purge illegal or undocumented people from the voter registration lists. That began last week with 2,600 of those names being sent out to the election supervisors across the state. But a quick examination of the names revealed that it included many, many citizens who were legitimately registered to vote and who would have been excluded from voting, including a World War II veteran, and just normal average folks who ended up on this list. The Miami Herald had done an examination of the list and found in their cursory review that at least 20% of the people that were on the list were actually registered validly under the law in Dade County.
Well, the study also found that 58% of the people on, or the Miami Herald news story found that 58% of the people that were on the list were Hispanic.
What a coincidence.
Yeah, what a coincidence.
But just a note, the Department of Justice sent a letter to Rick Scott and Secretary of State seeking a cease and desist on this practice under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act and also under the 1993 Voter Registration Act. That prohibits any kind of a change to voter registration within 90 days of an election. And because of the upcoming primaries in August, it prevents the state from taking such actions against legitimate voters.
But I believe, isn't he continuing anyway?
The administration of Governor Scott has been somewhat defiant in their public statements over the weekend, but the latest word as of this morning was that they are still reviewing the Department of Justice letter and will have a response by June 6th. Interestingly, and more importantly, all of the 67 counties in Florida, the election supervisors have said that they will not enforce the list and they will not send out the letters.
And that's pretty astonishing because, you know, they're elected officials, and there are an awful lot of counties in the state, especially in the central part of the state, in the north, in the panhandle part of the state, where people really wouldn't object to, probably, a lot of people really wouldn't object to people that they don't want to vote being removed from the voter rolls. So I think it's really a strong statement that every single supervisor of elections in the entire state has declined to comply with this order. And two, historically, this kind of purge has been shown to be, has shown to catch an awful lot of legally registered voters in the dragnet. And it's really, you know, if our purpose is to try to avoid voter fraud, you know, the number of cases of voter fraud just don't really justify removing this many people from the voter rolls. I mean, you're gonna disenfranchise what 189,000 people, of whom a strong proportion is going to be legally registered, so that four people don't vote, you know, as somebody else. It's ridiculous.
Better that one guilty man go free than 10 innocent men be put in prison
every single time. And we've really kind of lost track of that in our entire system of justice, I think. But you know, this is a really good. I'm glad that, you know, these decisions have come down and that these people are taking the stand.
If you just take the percentage that the Miami Herald found in the first batch of legitimate voters, and if 20% of the 182,000 people on the list, that would prevent 35,000 people who have valid voter registration certifications from voting.
And it's enough to swing it, and there are people who would be perfectly happy to have that happen.
If I might just give you a broader update, we were interested in seeing, because there's been 20 state laws that have passed, how the litigation that's been brought and how the Department of Justice actions have played out as the election draws nearer and nearer. The other aspects of the Florida law that were under challenge are that the law reduces the number of early voting days, including the last Sunday before the election, which is a day on which minorities traditionally vote in large numbers. It also eliminated the ability of registered voters who move within counties in Florida between elections from voting, from providing their new address on the election day and validly casting a vote. Under the Voting Rights Act, because five counties in Florida had previously been found to continuously violate the rights of voters, it was necessary for that law to be given either preclearance by the Department of Justice or be brought to court before a three-judge district panel in the U.S. District Court in D.C. Florida had sought preclearance of that, and a number of organizations, including League of Women Voters and the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, and if you don't know about that organization, it's a major civil rights lawyers organization in Washington, D.C. that does a lot of good work. They brought objections before the Department of Justice in that preclearance process. Rather than wait for a decision of the Department of Justice, Florida abruptly removed their preclearance petition and has brought that matter into court in D.C. And League of Women Voters and Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights have intervened in that action. And there's no decision from that court as yet. But as I say, the election draws near and we need a decision out of that court.
I'm sure it'll be coming soon. I guess we'll move on to the topic of today. Shannon, do you?
Okay. Every day we're exposed to thousands, if not tens of thousands, of chemicals. We trust in studies on the safety of these chemicals that are funded by the corporations usually that create the products. That's not often made public. Sometimes they fund a school, or the scientists who study it are on the boards of the corporations. These chemicals, I don't think people realize, some chemicals are excreted by the body. Some remain, are stored in fatty tissues, and they have multiplying effects on our health.
You're talking about chemicals like BPA. Is BPA actually stored in our tissue, or is it secreted? And I know that it interferes with our endocrine system. Is that
yes.
Right? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's an endocrine interrupter.
Yes, I think it is stored. I don't think it's excreted. The Union of Concerned Scientists is an incredible resource, along with Skin Deep, is that the Union of Concerned Scientists site?
I don't know.
If you go to skindeep.org, a lot of times it'll break down what the chemicals are and what their effects are. And we're not, you know, you say chemicals, people think, what are chemicals? We're not really talking about obscure things. We're talking about chemicals that are in our shampoo, soap, dish detergents, cleaning supplies, pesticides. Multiplying effects means that one chemical interacts with another chemical, you know, that accumulates in the body, and it has a worse effect than the single chemical would on its own. And the chemicals that I'm talking about are hormone disruptors, they're cancer causers, they brain damage, you know, we have just all kinds of health effects that don't show up right away when a product is produced. You know, they show up 10 years later or 20 years later in environmental cancers that no one can trace back where they came from.
Right. It's very hard, especially, I know I've seen some litigation on some of the chemicals, and it's very hard to isolate that a certain medical condition has come from this specific chemical.
So we're talking about how corporations, through the greening, so-called greening of their products and advertising that they do and participation in the regulatory process, how they deny the science that shows the harmful characteristics of some of these things in our lives.
And create pseudoscience that shows that they're actually beneficial. You know, one of the things I was reading this morning that I've been tracking ever since that hearing on drilling off our coast is CoreExit. I've actually been following CoreExit since they started, you know, pumping it. It's the ratio is 1 to 18 for gallons to the actual oil spill itself that we pumped this chemical in, under the presumption that it was going to disperse the oil. Well, it turns out it doesn't actually disperse it. It just makes it so that it goes into our food chain and possibly ends up in the aquifer, along with the original cancer-causing contaminants of the oil, which it doesn't disperse. It just makes it small enough to filter down faster.
And then we see a litany of ads from BP about how it's all good in the Gulf. People are back there. People are eating the fish. But what's the science?
Well, one, the fish have no eyes. Two.
And many of them have no lives.
Yes. One thing is, you know, in the research that I was reading, and this is how pervasive the kind of corporate structure is to continuing to line their own pockets regardless of the health effects to the public. The New York Times published in May of 2010 that the current leadership of Nalco, which was the producer of CoreExit, which is this chemical that was sprayed in mass amounts, included executives from BP and Exxon. And actually, I think the original owners, in large part, were Exxon. Yes, that's correct. Okay. So this chemical, which was used in the Exxon Valdez spill, has a horribly toxic chemical that caused health effects. I think the life expectancy went to 50 for people who were exposed to it during the Exxon Valdez spill, who were exposed to it in high quantities. There were 18 effective, some of them much more natural and even considered safe for general consumption, options to pour into this spill, but we used CoreExit. 12 of the 18 were 20... possibly up to 20 times or more less poisonous than CoreExit. But we used CoreExit. That's what we pumped in. And I don't think we can ignore the connection of BP to CoreExit.
Right, right. In the Gulf oil spill that happened several years ago, the government actually asked BP to stop using CoreExit, and they did not. There was a safer available chemical to use, but they had CoreExit on hand because they're making money off of it as well. Yeah. And
it's a great example of the kinds of things that the concerned scientists look at in their study of climate, of corporate control, they, you know, in addition to the BP example, they went back and looked at how things had developed with respect to things like leaded gasoline, acid rain, ozone pollution, and had determined that the corporations have taken kind of a, they kind of have a playbook on this, where at first they deny the science, then they go out and pay for bad science. They often exaggerate the costs of ameliorating the problems that, various climate impactors have, and eventually end up, while kind of trying to greenwash their companies as good corporate citizens, they go and lobby against laws and regulations that would ameliorate problems in various environmental contexts.
Because it will cost money.
Yep.
Jobs.
Jobs.
Oh, yeah.
Money.
Jobs. And, yeah, there's a... We know that all of the, not only petrochemical companies, but the all energy companies in particular are just really hurting for dollars.
They had a Proposition 23, which was a California environmental measure that was on the ballot, said that nothing could be done in terms of helping out the environment until unemployment was below 5.5% for a year.
Right. Well, we need to go. We need to take a break right now. But after the break, we'll be talking with Dr. Gretchen Goldman, who is from the Union of Concerned Scientists, and she is a co-author of the report we've been discussing about the corporate climate. And hope you'll stay with us.
Yeah, some say we don't deserve this earth we walk upon. Some say we don't deserve to breathe the air we pull into our.
Is proud to support community organizations with messages like this.
Have you been to the newly renovated Habitat for Humanity Restore? Located at 695 Mason Avenue, Daytona Beach, between Nova and US 1, the store is open Tuesday through Saturday from 9 to 4:30. New, used, and surplus donated goods of home furnishings, appliances, and building materials arrive daily. Our donors and customers help Habitat serve more families through the renovation and construction of affordable housing. Stop in today or phone at 386-226-2006 to arrange for the pickup of large donated items. Again, the number is 386-226-2006. If you value the opportunity to recycle, reuse, reduce, and rebuild, you will be a big fan of the Restore. The Restore supports Halifax Habitat for Humanity. Stop in today.
Hi, this is Liz from Air Occupy, and one thing that we've been talking about is getting local businesses. During this commercial break, we've asked for local businesses to come to advertise on our show. Instead of advertising, we're having a little trouble getting advertisers. If anyone wants to donate to keep us on the show, we would greatly, greatly appreciate it.
We're working really hard to make sure that we can get the message out and get some fresh content out there, things people may not have heard before, and we would really appreciate your support.
Thanks.
Hi,
we're back, and we're going to be talking with Gretchen Tanner Goldman, Dr. Gretchen Tanner Goldman. She is an analyst for the Scientific integrity program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She came to UCS from the Georgia Institute of Technology, where she did postdoctoral research on statistical modeling of urban air pollution. So we'll see if she's on the line. Dr. Goldman, are you on the line?
I am. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for coming on with us.
Sure.
Wanted to talk to you about the new study that came out. I guess it just came out last week about corporations controlling the climate dialogue and debate and also policy.
Yeah. We're very excited about it and really glad we could share it with you.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So the name of your report is A Climate of Corporate Control. And if anybody wants to read about it while we're talking on the radio, what's your website?
We can find the report is on our website in full, and there's also the executive summary and some other summary material if anyone's interested. And it is at www.ucsusa.org/corporate-climate, all one word.
Great, great.
How did you determine which companies you were going to study?
We wanted to look at a sample that wasn't predetermined to be opposed to climate science or science policy or for it. We wanted to just get an independent sampling, and we started with the S&P 500, specifically because public companies have to disclose a little more to the federal government about their activities and particularly their political activities. And so we started with publicly traded companies to be able to get at that information. And then within that, we chose companies who had taken a position on two policy proposals in 2009 and 2010. And those were that they publicly commented on the Environmental Protection Agency's finding that greenhouse gases endanger public health and welfare. If they commented on that finding, or if they donated either for or against Proposition 23, as you were discussing, which was a California ballot initiative that would have undermined the state's global warming mitigation law. And so we took companies that did either of those things to get sort of a objective sampling of what companies were doing on the climate policy debate at that time, and we found that gave us a sample of 28 publicly traded companies.
And the results were fairly mixed. So there were a few companies that walk the walk and talk the talk about environmental regulation. So they actually did what they were doing publicly was the same what they were doing behind closed doors. But then there were other corporations that did some greenwashing. Is that correct?
Yeah, we definitely found mixed results. You know, starting it off, we just did it that sample objectively, and so we didn't know what we were going to find. But, yeah, we found several companies who were, in our research, found to be consistent in how they behaved on climate science and climate policy. But then many of the companies we found had this inconsistent position, and so they would say some things publicly and then take other actions that didn't align with that. And specifically, we found that while all of the companies, every company in our sample had expressed concern about climate science somewhere, half of those companies also misrepresented the science elsewhere in their public communications.
So you looked at things like their marketing campaigns and websites and congressional engagement, political contributions, and a lot of different factors about their public face.
Right, yeah, and we specifically wanted to look at how they talked differently when they were talking with different audiences. So we looked at some of their public communications, like you said, their website and executives' public statements, any marketing campaigns they did, and also how they talked differently if they were talking to the government, such as in their congressional testimony, how they donated politically to members of Congress, lobbying expenditures, and their comments to the Environmental Protection Agency. And we also looked at how they had talked with investors of the company, and this included looking at their annual reports, how shareholders reacted to their their climate positions, and we looked at their earnings calls, which is when companies have conversations with financial analysts. So, yeah, we wanted to look at a bunch of places, anywhere that we could find that where companies had discussed climate change.
So, well, that sounds really in depth. That's quite a study, Dr. Goldman. Thank you for what you're doing. I mean, I don't know if you get enough thanks for the effort that you guys are putting into this for all of our well-being. What did you find? If you were going to boil it down, what are your findings?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, thank you. We appreciate the support since you know, this report was a long time in the making, and it took a lot of time. So I appreciate that it's getting out there so people can see it. So one of our main findings was just how difficult it is to get a lot of this information. These are publicly traded companies, and so a lot of what they have to disclose to the government, a lot of their political activity. However, we found that even what they're required is very insufficient in order to determine where these companies really stand on climate change and other issues of public concern. So we found that with this largely that we really need greater transparency in how these corporations are operating, and in order to hold them accountable to their investors and to the public, we really need to push for them to disclose more about their political spending, and that's both their direct political spending to candidates and their lobbying expenditures, but also their donations to other organizations, so to other think tanks and trade organizations and other groups that are also engaged on a lot of public policy issues. But companies are contributing to them, and so they're indirectly influencing the debate in that way.
So you came up with an ultimate kind of methodology where you would rate a company consistent, contradictory, or obstructionist. How did that break out in terms of the companies that you actually studied?
Yeah, so we looked at, we tried to find a way to sort of look at overall company behavior, and this was one figure where we had tried to do that, to really look at whether companies were taking consistent positions or not in how they were behaving on climate change specifically. So in doing that, we found quite a range between companies, and we found several companies who in our research were consistent on climate change and their behavior, and these included Nike, Applied Materials, AES Corporation, NRG Energy, and NextEra Energy. And these were the companies that, at least from what we were able to uncover, they had consistent stances. And the largest grouping was for our companies was in this contradictory category, where we had a lot of companies that had taken some actions and expressed some concerns about climate science and had taken some actions that were supportive of science-based climate policies, but they had also taken a lot of actions that had either undermined the policies or misrepresented the science. And then we had a group of companies at the end that we called obstructionist in their behavior, and these were companies that, in what we were able to uncover, it seemed that predominantly their actions served to block science-based climate policies or to misrepresent the science. And it's worth noting, even in this category, these were companies that had somewhere in their public communications also expressed concern about climate science and or climate change, rather. And so what we found is, you know, even though all these companies were expressing concern, there was a variety in terms of what they were actually doing in their actions that were less public.
Can you name some names, just so we all know?
Sure. So some of the companies that we found that were primarily obstructing the conversation on climate change were a lot of companies we found in the oil and gas industries, and these were Peabody Energy, Marathon Oil, for example, Occidental Petroleum, and FMC Corporation. And also for the contradictory companies, these are a lot of companies that either we didn't find too much about on their company that we could really definitively point to, but they did, however, take some actions that opposed climate science and policy and also those that supported it. And these were companies like ExxonMobil, Caterpillar, ConocoPhillips, some other companies that might be familiar to you, Waste Management.
Mm-hmm. So where can we go from here? What kind of recommendations for transparency do you make in your study?
We make several recommendations. One of the more prominent ones we see is currently in Congress, the Disclose Act is being considered, and this is an act that would really enhance disclosure of political spending for companies, but not only companies, but also for other outside organizations that are also contributing to the debate. And these are other groups that corporations are a part of, affiliated with, and are donating to, groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and mm-hmm. National Association of Manufacturers, for example. And so this is one piece of legislation we're really pushing for. It would enhance disclosure in terms of timing. Companies would have to disclose their political spending within 24 hours, which would be a significant improvement over the current situation. And it would also just improve how companies stand by their ads. There's a clause in it called Stand By Your Ad, which asks companies to disclose who the top donors were for political advertisements. And so this is something that we really push for. And we're also really pushing to hold these companies accountable to their shareholders and to the public. And so really emphasizing that we need to put pressure on these companies to ensure that they are being acting responsibly and having positions that align with climate science, but also that and they're not sending mixed messages out and confusing and making it more difficult for policymakers to really discern who's supporting climate science and who's blocking these efforts behind a climate concerned public image.
You know, this is Shannon. I want to sort of frame the issue a little bit. As a parent who's, and I'm also an environmentalist, you know, I do a lot of reading about climate change and, you know, what the effects are going to be for the next generation. Actually, some are going to occur in my lifetime and are already occurring. I don't think this information is really either getting out or being absorbed, maybe because of the obstruction by the general public. For instance, when I was talking earlier about Core Exit and the BP spill, which happened, you know, here in the Gulf off of Florida and Louisiana, and Democracy Now! Was interviewing Hugh Kaufman, who is a senior policy analyst at the EPA's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, and he stated, you know, this is his statement, it's a quote, and the government, both EPA, NOAA, et cetera, have been sock puppets for BP in this cover-up. The corporate interests are only concerned with their profit, and it blocks the public knowledge of what we're facing, of what's going on. I know James Hansen said that the effects are beyond his highest estimates already occurring for climate change. You know, what he originally estimated, I don't know if it would have been in 2003 or 2007. I caught it on a video by Jeremy Rifkin. Could you talk about the climate effects, the climate science, like the information that people are not getting that they need to get? Because I know Union of Concerned Scientists is very involved in climate research and getting that information out there.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, it's sort of this interesting phenomenon that we're seeing that the science is getting stronger and we keep finding more and more, you know, reasons to be concerned about climate change and what its impacts will be. And yet, you know, we have a public that remains largely, or many people in the public are still not clear on this or at least haven't received this information about the the concern and the advancement that the science has. So I think, you know, what we found is that there were various levels of engagement from these different companies, and so, you know, just because you're a company doesn't mean that you have to, you know, take this antagonistic role in the debate and be blocking policy. We found many companies, you know, were supportive consistently about of climate policies and, you know, and did have statements and actions that aligned with climate science. And so I think, you know, one important thing that we found to remember was that companies can play a responsible role, and we think, of course, that they should, but, you know, this is one, as you said, there's a lot of mixed messaging out there, and, you know, we hear a lot of different messages from companies, and so one thing that we would just recommend is just to really push these companies to be accountable to the public and to their shareholders, that they really need to disclose a lot of their information about their political spending, and they really need to have positions that are consistent with what the consensus of climate scientists are saying.
And there's so much generated controversy, pretend controversy, that it makes it really confusing for people. And in the polling that I've seen, the opinion studies that I've seen, when people are polled about that, there's a lot of variability back and forth. You know, and of course, obviously, it's different samples, but if the study is done correctly, we would assume that they would be largely representative. You know, that people kind of go back and forth between believing, I mean, as though it were a religious belief, you know,
right,
that
right.
there is something actually going on with regards to the climate that is human-caused, and not believing it. And it's, I think a lot of that, and I'm certainly not trying to tell you your business, because I know you know much more about this than I do, but it looks to me like it's because of this generated controversy, because people are constantly talking about it in the media. There are two sides to this, as though there are two sides to the fact that water will get you wet, you know, and that's the way it looks to me, you know, there's really, is there really any doubt about what's going on as far as you're concerned?
There's not doubt in as far as the actual, the fact that climate change is happening, it is largely human-caused, and, you know, as an organization, we feel it's something that we should all be concerned about. It's certainly, I share your frustration with these mixed messages and how that has played a role, and, you know, and that was largely the reason we wanted to do this study, is to really try to make sense of all these messaging that we're seeing from companies and from, you know, others in the media sphere.
Mm-hmm.
So, so basically our position is that you can't doubt the facts. So the facts of the climate science can't be debated. We're certainly, policy is something that can and should be debated nationally and with a lot of different stakeholders being able to weigh in, but, you know, our position is that the science shouldn't be debated by non-scientists.
Tough terrain out there when you have the likes of Fox News, who support global warming deniers. I mean, that Koch brothers trying to fund scientists to go out and debunk well-established theories and factual observations about climate change. I mean, we have a U.S. senator who is now the author of a book entitled The World's Greatest Hoax.
I'm glad you brought up the Koch brothers, because that's kind of another realm of concern that we have, is privately held companies. And so we only looked at publicly held companies because there is a little more information available on them publicly, but privately held companies don't have to disclose nearly as much information to the government and to the public, and so that's a whole other area of concern, because we know even less about what those companies are doing to influence public policy.
Very good. Very interesting.
Well, maybe you've provided a very useful matrix for future development, that we can apply these standards to every company who's trying to greenwash their practices or products.
And we can certainly spread the word on which companies are true to their values, just as you mentioned, and which are, you know, acting the opposite of what they're saying their interests are.
And to the extent we can do it, we can vote with our dollars. So if a company has support, you know, is saying the same thing about climate change publicly and privately, then we need to support them and tell them that we're supporting them because of it. I think that that's important.
I think also for support, we need to support Union of Concerned Scientists.
Definitely.
because you guys are you're a nonprofit.
The Earth is round.
And right. They're doing great work, and we need people who are publishing information that we can use that's not tainted by someone else's self-interest.
Well, Dr. Goldman, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about this study. Again, if people want further information.
Can you just tell us where people can find this information so I can put it on the blog?
Sure, yeah. So all the full report, as well as any additional information on Union of Concerned Scientists and the work that we do in general, is online at www.ucsusa.org/corporate climate.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your work.
Thanks for all you do.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
So we're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we will be speaking with Rachel Collins of Deep Green Resistance. Okay, technical difficulties.
We're still on.
We're still on. Why don't we go straight to Rachel? Hello, this is Air Occupy. You're on the air.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me on. It's great to hear all of you.
Great.
Oh, thanks, Rachel.
Morning.
Thanks. So tell us a little bit about Deep Green Resistance and I know I've read a little bit on your website. It's a pretty interesting and different perspective on energy consumption.
Right. Well, the basic stance of DGR is that we're past the point where small-scale remedial types of actions are going to be able to provide the types of change needed to prevent the population collapses, global toxification that we see happening today, and that includes global warming. So DGR is an above-ground resistance movement, which means that our actions fall into legal actions, including direct action against extraction against those practices that actually are creating climate change. But calling ourselves an above-ground movement does imply that we are also advocating for underground actions that together can create the type of material change that we need to avert, further catastrophes from the types of practices that characterize industrial civilization.
So are you talking off-grid and community gardens? What kind of actions are you talking about here?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, part of what DGR is trying to accomplish is rebuilding the land base that's been destroyed by the types of practices that characterize our civilization today. So that means, alternative food production. It means perennial polyculture instead of using monoculture, which, when we talk about climate change, something that we leave out a lot of the time is that 20% of the U.S.'s emissions are caused by industrial agriculture, and that's not only the pesticides and the, fertilizers and things like that, which are made of fossil fuel, but it's also the practice of agriculture itself. Agriculture, as done today, releases carbon, whereas an actual functioning ecosystem is a carbon sink. So we have to look further than just, our use of energy. We have to look at how is our food being produced, how does the basic organization of our society contribute or resist these types of destructions. And I thought it was very interesting. I want to thank Dr. Goldman for her expertise. That was really informative right before me, but also that she was speaking about how there's this disconnect between what we know about the science and what the public actually believes. And I read something very interesting yesterday that was about, it was a Yale University study, and they looked at how people's scientific literacy impacts their views on climate change. And they found that actually their scientific literacy, their ability to understand the research, was nowhere near as influential as their cultural values. So we're not dealing with people that are making decisions on whether they have enough information. We're dealing with whether those, you know, that information fits in with their pre-existing views about the nature of society, the nature of humanity. And, you know, we can point to a lot of, you know, societies today or, you know, subcultures today where we know that scientific literacy is not looked at as a, you know, a virtue. We can look at creationism. We can look at things like that, and it really doesn't make me or anyone in DGR hopeful that more information is going to cause the kind of tipping point that would be needed.
People are reluctant to accept the science if it doesn't fit with their cultural perspective.
The way I read the study was it kind of had to do with how your friends stood. You didn't want to buck up against the, you know, your group of, you know, friends and neighbors with something really different because, you know, we're kind of herd animals, I guess.
Pack animals.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. And, I mean, you know, we can look at, there's been a large popular movement towards, you know, going green and all of that. But when we look at the actions that actually describe that movement as it exists today, we see a lot of the same issues that kind of plague the liberal left in the United States, which is that, you know, individual lifestyle actions do not cause a material impact in the type of destruction that we're seeing. I mean, I was really glad that Dr. Goldman brought up the James Hansen study, because that, to me, was really... You know, that kind of cemented my view that we can't rely on, you know, the state and the corporations that are benefiting from these types of practices to be the ones that change them. They're not going to make a voluntary change towards a more sustainable way of life.
Could you restate that where you said our material, like the actions that we take as individuals are not going to have a material effect? Could you restate that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we make a lot of actions. We can recycle. We can... you know, use less of certain products. You know, the previous caller mentioned, you know, voting with our dollars, voting in the first place. All of those kind of actions that are taken by individuals don't have a material impact on the crisis, because the crisis is not being caused by individuals. The vast, vast majority of the carbon emissions and ecological destruction happening in the United States has nothing to do with individuals and everything to do with corporations and the choices that they make. As long as they are still able to profit off of extractive industry and, you know, the types of things that cause this destruction, they're not going to make that change on their own. So, you know, I think to the Frederick Douglass quote that, like, you know, power concedes nothing without a demand, I think that it's still true today. Unless we're demanding in a material way through blockades, through sabotage, through anything that makes a material impact. So DGR's view is that we need to be looking at what's effective, not what can be done without rocking the boat too much.
So are you also advocating, do I understand that you're, hi, this is Virginia, how you doing? Do I understand that you all also are advocating a real return, a genuine return to a different style of life than the one that we live in the 21st century, that is much less dependent on technology and resources, energy, things like that? Do I misunderstand?
Oh no, I think you hit the nail on the head there. We have to look at the different ecological crises that we're seeing, and I mean they're vast, they're numerous, they're intractable. We have to look at them as not individual problems in and of themselves, because if we're only treating the symptoms, we're not going to be able to do anything about the cause. And the cause, as we can understand it, is industrial civilization. So, you know, we're not only talking about the 21st century, it's the last 10,000 years where humans have been living in too high of concentrations on land that cannot support them. So there is no city in existence today that doesn't overshoot the carrying capacity of the land it's built on. So, you know, if you put too many beings that need water and food and space on a piece of land that can only support so many, much, much fewer than the type of human populations that we're trying to support today, there's nothing that population can do other than resort to colonialism, to extraction, to you know, taking these resources by force from neighboring peoples. It's what we saw with the ongoing genocide of Native Americans. It's what we see happening in the Middle East. It's what we see very starkly with Africa. So all of these together point to ecological destruction as not being a series of unconnected symptoms. It's a larger problem. We have to put the pattern together. And look at the fact that our basic social organization can never be sustainable. There's no amount of action that we can do that would cause civilization to suddenly be something that can sustain itself past the next 50 years if we're lucky.
Wow. that's a very interesting and striking concept.
Sobering
assessment as well.
Yeah, I definitely find it to be so. And, you know, I think a lot of what we talk to, you know, I think something that we need to keep in mind is that we do need it all. There are many above ground actions. Most of my life as an activist has been spent doing, you know, liberal types of activism where, you know, pressuring the state, doing petitions, applying political pressure. I've seen those things work. They can work in certain situations. But I think to limit our political activities to those types of things that are acceptable to the very perpetrators of the ecological destruction in the first place is not going to lead to the types of meaningful change that we're going to need. So I think, I mean, we refer to ourselves as a radical movement. Radicalism means looking at oppression as happening in groups. Groups of people are oppressed by groups of other people. So individual actions are not going to address that type of group oppression. And we're also looking at materialism. You know, adding more information to the debate, as we've seen, has not been able to sway most people from their loyalty to the economic system.
Right.
So if your loyalty lies with the economic system instead of the actual systems of life that support you, you're going to do everything in your power to defend that economic system. But since we know that the higher GDP grows, the more destructive we are to the environment, you know, the economy is not going to save us. The economy is the problem. So all of these actions that are looking for green jobs, that are looking for, you know, making sure that we can have a sustainable energy economy, all of those things are, you know, oxymorons in and of themselves.
We are running out of time, but quickly tell us about your summer program that you're doing, going up the East Coast.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I think it relates back to what you were saying before about people don't want to act outside of a community. We are social creatures. We rely on that intimately for all of our actions, you know, that we can take individually or collectively. So the idea behind this roadshow, this series of presentations, is creating a culture of resistance, a culture of people, a community that can support each other through taking these types of large-scale actions. It's not something that's going to be, you know, easy. It's not something that any of us are going to be able to do on our own. So we really need to be able to make those connections, to have those conversations, to, you know, just like we've been having today, to talk about really what's causing these problems and stop addressing the symptoms individually. So we're going to be going to several cities on the East Coast, starting in Miami on June 16th. You can get more information about it on the Deep Green Resistance website, but we would love to meet current activists, potential activists on these dates to have the discussion that we've been having today.
Well, great. Well, thanks so much for talking with us. Very, very interesting stuff. And if you want more information, you can go to Deep Green Resistance's website, right?
Yep, deepgreenresistance.org. And if you'd like to find out if there's a Deep Green Resistance chapter in your area, if you live in Central Florida, there's one already in Orlando that I've been a part of for a while, but they're springing up all over the place. If one doesn't exist where you are, we would love it if you contacted us about starting one.
Excellent. Terrific. Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.
So it looks like we're running up on time.
Just wanted to note that Governor Rick Scott will be at the Ocean Center at noon tomorrow in an event sponsored in part by the Chamber of Commerce. Let's get out and give dude a good old Occupy Daytona Beach welcome.
And we're coming up next week. I think there's a hearing about the protected lands for St. John's River Water Management. For more information, please go to Occupy Daytona Beach's website. You can find more information. And the Occupied Daytona Beach Journal is now has a new issue out, so you can also find that there.
And for all of our Wisconsin listeners, get out and vote.
Cool. This has been Air Occupy.
Peace.
Hey!
This program was paid for by its sponsor, which is solely responsible for its content and the views expressed.